With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Smirchpod Royale.
My name is Bond, James Bond. My instructions were implicit. I was to leave for Jamaica in 2 hours. License to kill.
Now you maybe miss it.
You don't miss a thing.
I decided to accept your invitation.
I have to leave immediately.
The explosive screen dramatization of the book that has entertained millions of readers. The exotic and tantalizing Dr. No.
Some people will go to any extremes for a little privacy.
Hello and welcome to Smirchpod Royale, a podcast celebrating all the Bond films by those who enjoy, hate, or, you know, just aren't asked about them, hosted by me, John Raine. This week we'll be heading to Jamaica, of our own accord, to battle spiders, fight dragons, and try and stop a man who does take no for an answer. Yes, it's Dr. No! And joining me to crush golden statues to prove our virility and strength is writer, author, and Bond fan, Mark O'Connell.
Hey, how are we doing? How's the line in Jamaica? Are we getting this?
We're good. We're coming direct from Crab Key.
Great. Yes, I've got Strangway's secretary on the comm links. It usually works.
Strangway's, here we come.
Yep.
It's my favourite joke. So, Mark, supply your credentials for those who don't know.
Yes. Which one? Oh, that one, the Bond one.
The Bond one.
Yeah, I'm a Bond fan. I always say that. I'm a Bond fan, writer, author. Wrote a book called Catching Bullets, Memoirs of a Bond Fan, which grew out of a rather different broccoli springboard, as I call it, where my grandfather was chauffeur and other things. Worked with Cubby for well over 30 years and was, well, Cubby and Broccoli and Bond were in my family before I ever was. So I sort of inherited it. I became the family fan. And I just wrote a book about being an 80s Bond kid. It was sort of my attempt to do Fever Pitch for the VHS Roger Moore generation. And it sort of snowballed from there in a great, happy, universal exports type way.
It's a magnificent book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And I'm so pleased to finally got it, because we've been talking about this for bloody ages.
Yeah, we were talking about this before No Time to Die started filming. So this was like sort of 42 years ago.
Yeah, No Time to Die was 1986, wasn't it? They started
That's right. That's when it was going to come out. Yeah,
Sana's very good.
So. On this day in Bond history, No Time to Die was coming out, but I'm sure it will come out eventually.
Did you do that mild sigh when you realised that that was the day you were going to go and see it?
My phone, in fact, it still does it. I never went through my phone and deleted appointments for the rest of the year. And on premiere night, that was a bit of a harsh one, as I was sort of sat in my Star Wars pyjamas, nestling a slightly warm glass of gin, going, yeah, could have been somewhere very different tonight.
My YouTube algorithm threw up the trailer again the other day.
Oh, that's harsh.
I know. I was like, oh, watch it again. And it was only when I was watching it, when Ralph Fiennes stands up and says, where's 007? I suddenly thought, oh, we might not be talking about Bond.
Yeah,
I got all excited again.
Yeah, no, it was one of those tragic things, but it'll happen. Let's see if it happens in November.
And as it turns out, it was completely the right decision.
Yes, yeah, but I mean, the decision got slightly mocked and ridiculed. But Bond, guess what? Bond sometimes is ahead of the curve. And if and when these things can come back to us and the celluloid can start flickering again, I feel Bond could be like the Ben-Hur poster boy of all of this in terms of movies and entertainment. So just a little more patience will draw, hopefully, a better prize. And it was a shame because I was beginning to hear really great little things, you know, very privately, very off the record, that there was a confidence with the film and it was done, people were happy with it, the whole reshoot thing and it needing to go back was a load of old stale martini rubbish, that was. I think people are happy with it. It's a bit like, you know, like the athletes that can't go to the Olympics. The Bond camp were primed and trained and ready for this, suddenly to have to stop at the last moment and sort of go back to the bench as hardest for them more than anyone.
Oh yeah, especially as they were all kind of geared up to do all the promotion around the time, weren't they? I mean they've probably got hours of interviews stored away till November now, I'd imagine.
Yeah, and poor Daniel Craig, he can't like have a beer or a kebab for like eight months. Because normally he's sort of just gone off the film into the premiere. But just fingers crossed. I'm sort of keeping an eye on other franchises, like, oh, what's Black Widow doing? Or, you know, is that going to maybe... I mean, people said, oh, look at Trolls 2, it came out online and has done well. But I don't think Trolls 2 will be securing another 23 Trolls films.
No.
So, Bond has different missions to accomplish when it comes to cinema.
No.
So, we'll see.
Trolls 2 may have finished itself by the time everyone's finished watching it. So.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And it's... I could be very wrong, but I don't think streaming online is where the future of Bond is for right now.
No. No, but it seems fitting that we've just talked about the latest, the 25th, and now we're going to talk about the very first.
The 21st first, yes, yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
I was just going to say, the very first James Bond film from 1962.
I know. Cool. I was really pleased to see it again. I've seen it. It was as a kid, and we talked about this. It's one of those films where, one of those Bond films, because I was Team Roger, I was Generation Transamerica. I came in the late 80s, really. But so I kind of picked them up going backwards a hell of a lot. And Dr. No and From Rush With Love and Thunderball, they felt like the vinyl the appearance had, that sometimes was cool if you listened to it. But other times, no, I just want to hear Band-Aid. Not that I'm equating Band-Aid with, Thunderball. But
Well, it goes on a bit. And there's the underwater sequence at the end in Band-Aid that no one likes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and both have Boy George doing really random things. But no, I am always surprised by how slick Dr. No is. And I don't want to talk over perhaps your trajectory of attack here, but I watched it again last week and I was like, my God, this is a fully fledged Bond film already. Its greatest trick is it's pretended we've missed five Bond films, I think.
Yeah, it is.
You know, they forget the usual repartee and all of that. It's like, yeah, it's really trying to put its hand in the air and say, look, we can make more of these. It's a very plucky film with a great hunger to prove itself. And I think mostly successfully does.
It feels like a demo. Of like when you hear a really good song and then they release the reissue years later and then on the bonus track is a demo of it and you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, funny you say that. I think the one factor that's aged most badly when it comes to Dr. No is its music score. Mm. And it's not so much the score itself, it's just the mixing in and out of it. I was like, oh my God, he's just opening a hotel door here and suddenly we have the Bond theme plowing through. And the way it drops in and out, it was a very different era of music editing and mixing, but it's really what film composers call Mickey Mousing. He walks into a room, so does the theme. It's demo tapey with its own demo tape.
Yeah. Isn't John Barry. John Barry just does the theme, doesn't he, at the end? Monty Norman scored this. And obviously didn't know, with all the best will in the world, and why would you if you've written it, what you had.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, he did his, Monty Norman did it because he was like one of the sort of West End darlings of the time. And
yes.
Obviously had a good meeting with the Broccoli and Saltzman camp. When you listen to the score of Dr. No, it's trying to do this weird 1950s TV detective drama sound. It barely just breathes, and it doesn't have those John Barry arrival moments or those John Barry midnight sunset, you know, romance moments. It's just forever American detective sound. And I can slightly understand why maybe Monty Norman was put to one side a little bit when they pushed forward with From Russia with Love.
You can, because when Barry gets his score, his arrangement of the theme, you just think, actually, I'd rather that guy. Thanks.
Mm. Yeah, it's a weird, because there's sort of the Cool Cat sounds of John Barry's arrangement of that, and he did more than arrange it. He might not have, you know, written all the letters and all the right numbers, but he just gave life and oxygen and light to that piece of music as well.
Yeah.
And you've got this, as I say, sort of clunky. Slightly the worst thing about Monty Norman's score for it is it's yesteryear. It just sounds so dated. All right, it will do nearly 60 years later, but I've kind of felt it might have been like that at the time. Although saying that, I think I love the Jamaican jump up stuff.
Yeah.
It feels like Monty Norman had and maybe that's partly why they pulled him into the film, because he had his eye on that sound, and it felt like early. I mean, I'm not a big musician historian here, but there's a sort of Jamaican sound there that was just about to, you know, to come over and swamp the mod scene and really, you know, and move out into the club scene of London. And I think he was very clever to get that. And I love the sort of the songs of the film actually are better than the score.
Yes. Also, you know, the story Monty Norman tells about how he was asked to do it and he was a bit hesitant.
Mm.
And then they said, you can bring your whole family out to Jamaica.
Yes.
And he was like, yeah. Oh, yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, it's fine.
And then Bless This House wife came with him and doubled up for Dana Coupland, who was his wife at the time. She obviously did the one of those factoids we all heard as a kid. But she did the actual singing of, I think, one of 52 people dubbing Ursula Andress in that film.
Yeah, she sang Underneath the Mango Tree.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, when Sean joins in.
Mm. Yes. So
Monty Norman's song, originally it was called Bad Sign, Good Sign.
Mm.
For a proposed musical he was writing for that, A House for Mr. Biswas.
And wasn't the opening line or the line of the Bond theme, I was born with an unlucky sneeze, which is so zeitgeist for 2020. Perhaps Monty knew something we didn't.
We've gone full circle, Mark.
Yes.
But the film kicks off with a Queen's Club, a private members only, where the aforementioned Strangeways is playing cards with his friends.
Mm.
And then is immediately murdered by three blind mice, which we get in the opening credits, which again are quite schizophrenic because you have, as we mentioned, the Jamaican music, and you've got this like bongo solo, and then three blind mice done as a Jamaican sort of cod reggae version. But again, it's like we were talking about, the things are there, like Monty Norman's, is it Monty Norman who did the credits for this? I'm sure it is, isn't it? Not Monty Norman, Maurice Binder.
Oh, Maurice Binder, he definitely did them, and allegedly very late in the day with bits of round sticky white circles that he almost found in a corridor and just threw at the meeting he had to have.
And it was his idea to put a homemade pinhole camera inside a gun barrel to shoot at Bob Simmons. And apparently that was very last minute.
Yes.
And then here we are like 50 odd years later, and that is the iconic Bond thing.
Yeah, I mean, often the last minute decisions or creative decisions are the ones that stick the best. I think those titles, they, again, watching it recently, those titles are so fast and energetic for a film that's nearly 60 years old. And when you look at other cinema that was around, To Kill a Mockingbird and any other film that I can't think of that came out in 1962, it's, again, there's a pulse and a pluck about those titles that, you know, sets out the Bond table brilliantly from the get-go.
Absolutely. But after Strangways is murdered, we then see his secretary. She's murdered. And the files for Crab Key and Dr. No are taken.
Yes, they do love a good filing cabinet in a Bond film, even from the get-go. I used to think, always think it was Peter Lamont, who was obsessed by filing cabinets in his production design. But no, Ken Adam got there first.
Because Peter Lamont famously put the, was it Moneypenny have her makeup in a filing cabinet.
Oh, that's right. Yes, yes, yeah, yeah.
I think it might be Octopussy.
It's one of the 80s. Yeah. She's doing probably not Octopussy because she's got her little assistant in that one. But yeah, yeah, it's a weird moment where because all women want to look good in the workplace,
especially when James Bond's coming.
Yes, yeah, and she's forgot to get Angel Delight from the local co-op, so she can't woo him for dinner.
Exactly. But so London are concerned because they haven't heard from their man in Jamaica. So they decide to send a message to their top agent at the club, which is called Le Cercle, L'Ambassadeurs London. Which is kind of a sort of reassuring club for upper class people where you can, it looks like you could run over a poor person in the car park and no one would mind.
Yes, yeah, and it's actually a real place and it's a gorgeous set. I was again watching it going, that's a beautiful set because it's all one sort of set and one vision. I suppose it is the set that launches Bond, so they have to slightly go for it. But again, it's that there's a sense of old school, you know, English, London, private members club traditions, and Bond just already is presented as someone's beyond that already. He's like, that's not his world. He can move within it, but it's not actually his world.
And we talk about things they got right in this film, and you can't argue for a second, because it's always number one in the most iconic Bond moments ever.
Mm.
Connery's introduction as Bond. I mean, it's phenomenal.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, he sort of gives his name when no one really fully asks. I know she asks, who are you? But he sort of gives the full moment. And the score, you know, the theme. If Monty Norman can throw up the score at any point, then that's the point he's allowed to. Some of the rest of it in the film's a little clunky. But yeah, when he pulls that in and Connery lights a cigarette, it is a moment, yeah. And it probably felt like a moment at the time as well. That's why it's, you know, so important,
yeah.
I would imagine. It didn't just become iconic 20 years later. It was iconic sort of 20 minutes later.
It makes you wonder whose decision it was ultimately to have him say Bond, James Bond, because, again, much with the gun barrel.
Yeah, maybe it's a Terence Young thing. The director, he was quite keen on the chap essence of Bond, the gentleman, the accoutrements. Perhaps that was just one of his affectations.
Because that's who Connery credits with his Bond performance, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. I mean, Terence Young took Connery under his wing when he was cast very famously. And there was that famous line about wear your suit in bed or crunch it up or something just so you can feel it's yours and a good suit won't crease anyway.
Yeah, because Connery later said Sean Connery is not James Bond, Terence Young is James Bond.
Yes.
And I think that's, for someone like Connery, who seems like can be a bit of a dick, to be saying that decades later, that just shows the impact he had on him and how he couldn't possibly say for 1 minute that it wasn't down to himself.
Yes. Yeah, and Terence Young was the first man to direct No Time to Die as well.
Yes, that's right.
For fact fans, yes.
Yeah. And it's got everybody, and I think Bernard Lee's in it as well.
Yeah, in the Tank Force of No Time to Die. Yeah, there's a lot of Anthony Newley who went on to do Golf.
There's a hell of a lot of Bond people who worked on the original No Time to Die. Yeah. It's quite funny.
That's not an accident either, I would imagine. That's a good, nice way of going full circle, I think.
Yeah. So Bond gets his message and he goes to see M. And this is where you get a bit of a strange bit. Where he first walks into Universal Exports, we first meet Moneypenny, and he goes to see M. And we get the scene where we meet the first Q, so Major Boothroyd, played by a different actor who takes away his Beretta and gives him his Walther PPK. And we get a moment where M says that they're working for MI7, but as he says it, you can see that his lips are saying MI6.
Oh, right.
Which feels like a great pub quiz question.
Mm. And it's also, I'll give you another one. I think I picked up recently, I'm no gunsmith, but, and I could be wrong here, and I'll probably get pulled over the Bond gun.
You will, yes.
I will. I think it's not a Walther PPK, it's a Walther PP.
Mm.
But I will put my hand in the air and get shot with any size gun if I'm wrong on that one.
I always get shot, don't worry about it. They'll leave you alone.
Yeah, as long as it's not with a Beretta, because that's a girl's gun.
It's a girl's gun. Yeah. But this is interesting at this point because we're getting Bond slowly getting stripped away to the Bond we know, because in this film he loses the Beretta and then in Goldfinger he loses the Bentley and gets the Aston Martin. So it's slowly sort of evolving into the part that, I mean, you could argue that from Goldfinger onwards he doesn't change at all, apart from the Lotus and the different Aston Martins and BMWs or whatever. As his setup, it remains the same. But these early ones, it's gradually sort of accruing bits that become the James Bond we know later on.
Well, the movie Bonds like to... They use Fleming, the Harvard's DNA, even up, you know, No Time to Die. I'm sure as many well-thumbed paperback Flemings sat on the script table there. But they also like to put their own stamp, you know, whether it's a moment of finality by dumping Blofeld out of Becton Gasworks chimney in Fury's Only to sort of say, sort of, I mean, that was about a different sort of political thing with McClory and Co. Yes. But yeah, they like to slightly just show their independence. Also, you know, it was the 60s. We have to slightly move on. And that's, you know, if Fleming's Bond was such a post-war project of 1950s-ness, then the cinematic Bond had to evolve into the 60s and move it away from that a bit.
Yeah, a bit. But we should also say as well, when we're talking about No Time to Die and this, there's another parallel in that this and No Time to Die have got the only cases that I can think of where a female is part of the screenwriting team.
Mm, yes. Yeah, Joanna Harwood, she did this and she had a sweep through on From Rush of Love, the next film. She's not the only one. She's the only credited one.
I was going to say credited, I should say.
Yeah, because there's, you know, Dana Broccoli alone, Cubby Broccoli's wife, her hand and eye, you know, fingerprints were on a lot of those Bond scripts and those key Bond decisions. And I always say in the book that Bond was never made in a male vacuum. And even in 1999, when they shot World Is Not Enough, I want to say Dana Stevens, who was Mike Lapted's partner, she had a sweep through and wrote it. So yeah, women doing Bond or writing Bond is not that new, not when you consider it kicked off that way. But yeah, all more power to Phoebe Waller-Bridge and what she brings.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't wait to see it. Also in this one, we got Sylvia Trench, who becomes sort of Bond's girlfriend, because another thing people forget is in the beginning of From Rush with the Glove, he's still with her. He's the lady he's with at the river when he's called at the beginning.
The plan was to probably have her in every film for a while, but then I suppose Moneypenny, that was her role.
Yeah.
And I believe Eunice Gayson's daughter crops up in one of the later films, I'm sure, maybe just as a sort of poolside beauty, but I'm sure she sort of came back to the circus.
I wonder if it's Die Another Day. That's where they put all the cameos, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, everyone's kids in that one.
Yeah.
Roger Moore and, yeah. Could be. Again, I will check that out.
I think George Lazenby dangles his balls into one shot in Die Another Day.
Oh, right, yes. Oh, gosh, that's a vision, isn't it?
It's disguised as a lava
lamp. Is it 1969 balls or his 2002 balls?
It's 2002.
These things matter.
2002 balls, but they CG'd them.
Yeah, well, I suppose the older ones would actually be visible in frame.
and they make them invisible, like the car, so you can't see them, but he's there.
But the cameras are really heavy on his knackers.
Yeah. And they make it look like a lava lamp, so it's really tasteful.
Yeah, I'm with that.
So Bond basically gets, he's told, you have to go to Jamaica and investigate this because we don't know what's happened to them. So he takes his new gun, has a bit of a romp with Sylvia, and then flies off to Jamaica. And he's being watched to the airport by a mystery man who we later find out is Felix Leiter. Now, our first Felix is Jack Lord from Hawaii Five-0, which at the time... Well, no, was Hawaii Five-0 big at the time? I think it might have been.
It was big. I don't think it was quite a thing yet. My Hawaii Five-0 history is not great.
Same.
Not sure it quite kicked off in 62.
No, it feels later, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was more of... Yeah, I can see it's more of a sort of 66, 67 thing. And a friend of mine's a massive fan, so I can hear him texting me angry now.
I think they should bring it back with Paul Dano as the lead part, so they can say, I'm going to book him, I'm Paul Dano.
Possibly.
Wouldn't work as well.
No.
But I think it would be a good nod. He could also put his sunglasses half down and wink.
My name's Jason Fleming. The More Than My Past podcast will see me talking to a wide range of inspiring people. People who have confronted and overcome addiction or imprisonment or both and turned their lives around.
I did mad things that was hurting myself and hurting other people.
Everybody grows up in a house called normal. Heroin addiction and chaos was my normal.
Some people don't understand the word moderation, and I was definitely one of those people.
The More Than My Past podcast.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I like Jack Lord in the film. He's kind of...
I think he's great.
He was young. He was youthful. And I always say Dr. No from Rush with Love, they have this sort of Kennedy era sense of 60s about them, which is mostly a hangover of the 50s.
Whereas, also, Kennedy was one of the last films Kennedy watched from Rush with Love.
It's one of his favourite... Yes, one of his favourite books.
Yeah. I'm sure he saw the film before he was killed.
It's a bit like Elvis. The last film he saw was Spy Who Loved Me. It's sort of like... Can famous men of the 20th century stop watching James Bond films, please?
Yeah.
But yeah, so Jack Lord's part of that. He has that sort of Kennedy era, you know, Cape Cod, slicked back hair and glasses.
He doesn't do a lot in this, but he's very good at what he does.
Yes, yeah. And it's, you know, it was kind of, because Jack Lord was probably more of a name. Certainly the camera really picks up on him. And Connery walks in as this semi-unknown. It was a bold move because to have a Felix that's, dare I say it, slightly better looking and has got more... screen oomph than, you know, early Connery.
Yeah, I mean, Connery, we should probably say that as well. I mean, it takes a lot of balls to do what they did here, because Connery, it wasn't like he was an unknown, but he wasn't a leading man known. And to cast him as this huge role was...
Yeah, absolutely. And that was down again partly to Dana Broccoli, who... This is one thing I always try and say in the book and say whenever I talk about Bond, there's this assumption that... And it was there with Ursula Andress coming out of the surf with her bikini and you know, Jill St. John. And it gets, the Bond films get chastised for in their heyday being a bit sexist. And I always say there's a difference between sexist and sexy. But people always overlook that Connery was not an ugly, you know, ugly old uncle. He was a hot, virile man. I mean, those scenes where he's having that weird Karen Silkwood nuclear shower, you know, just have a bit of bubble bath here and that gets rid of all sort of toxic nuclear energy. But he's hot. He is really hot. Yes, so is Ursula Andress. And that gets overlooked. So, yeah, he comes in and, again, it's not the role as written. The role is not as virile and as panther-like as Connery often gets described. I do think time has still not caught up with how much Connery brought to that role. There's a lot of accoutrements. There's a lot of DNA, whether it's Maurice Binder or Peter Hunt, the editor, and even Ken Adam and the suits and the whole pulse of it. It will only work because Connery finally and ultimately made it work.
Watching this, you can totally understand about the terror they had with For Majesty's Secret Service of having to have someone new. To the point where all the marketing came out beforehand with no face on it because they didn't want to scare people away with what the new guy looked like. So you had this kind of blank face on the posters. And you can understand it, though, because when they must have watched back the rushes of this, they must have just thought, Christ, what have we got here?
Yeah, I can imagine there's always a concern about Connery. But, you know... Perhaps it took an American and a Canadian producer just to slightly think outside the box. Although, admittedly, Terence Young, British director. But I doubt if it had a British director, I don't think Bond would have maybe cast Connery. It would have been more of an Albert Finney or a Patrick McGoohan. It would have been someone that was slightly more established. And, you know, the hardest role in cinema at the time to cast. I don't know if it wasn't quite the screen test hunt that Scarlett O'Hara was, I'm sure. But it was...
But isn't this the down to Dana Broccoli as well with Connery? Isn't she the one who said he walked like a panther?
Yeah, and she'd seen Darby O'Gill and The Little People, which was that slightly mawkish Leprechaun-y late
50s. It's terrible.
Film.
If you haven't seen it, don't bother with
it. I saw it one Saturday afternoon on ITV and it was just like, oh, shit.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, it was like, oh, my God.
It's interesting seeing Connery at least try and do another accent, which he would repeat again in The Untouchables, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a dreadful film.
But it got him noticed. It was, you know, springboard into this.
It's always interesting to see with any actor, particularly ones who go on to play these huge parts, the sort of small parts. It's like when you see Harrison Ford in American Graffiti.
Yes.
Things like that. You're like, oh, I can see how he became this huge megastar after this, because he's clearly outshining everybody in this scene with how he looks.
Yeah, I mean, with Connery, ultimately, and Roger Moore as well, you can't just walk into a frame and say Bond, James Bond. You have to bring something of your own to the table. And Connery, particularly in Dr. No, is almost that panther-like phrase. That panther is used way too much, but there's a sort of balletic grace to how I was watching it going, God, you almost move like a drag queen. It's like one foot in front of the other, like you're in heels. Mm. There's a real plodding, you know, sort of sultry feline gait to him. And I'm sure that's what they picked up on.
Also, former bodybuilder, so kind of used to presenting himself physically.
True, but it was one of those, era of bodybuilding where it was all that Robert Mitchum, just breathe in and do this, that dads do at, you know, summer barbecues. It wasn't really your ripped Ryan Gosling.
No, true. But if you look at him in this and then Diamonds Are Forever, you can see one's a bodybuilder, one's a fellow who likes smoking and drinking.
I kind of love his body in Diamonds Are Forever. Not actually love it, but I remember there was a cut, the version that was on ITV, where I'm sure, and this is in my weird pubescent head, I'm sure, but I'm sure I saw the top of Connery's lower thatch. I'm like, oh my God. And then
I think you do, yeah. It's that bit where he's walking, Austin Powers like.
Yeah, yeah.
He's walking across the room, but everything kind of blocks his groin. But at the one minute, you see a bit of pube, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I was like, oh no, that is literally like catching your dad in the bath. Like, oh no, I didn't need to see that. Oh, quick, put on Dr. No, get him back to Jamaica where he's kind of hot and cool.
Because there's that bit in Diamonds Are Forever when he's on like a little moon buggy scooter thing with the fat tyres, and it looks like a dad on holiday in Lanzarote.
That's right. But that's what's glorious about that film. It has a sort of 1 a.m, the nightclub's over vibe to it, literally and metaphorically.
I will defend that film to my dying day. I love
it. I love Diamonds Are Forever. I do actually think it's one of the best Bond films. And again, it doesn't get much credit for that. But just the dialogue alone is the best dialogue of any Bond film, it's collectively.
It's like they've thrown a Roger Moore film at Sean Connery.
But through a sort of Batman 60s lens of barbed wit. And it's really stabbing, that film. It stabs at Peter O'Toole, Disney, Mickey Mouse, Bambi and Thumper, Playboy. It's really stabbing American culture very carefully. And that's all Tom Mankiewicz and his... I'd love to have met him. Would have been one of my dinner party guests, Tom.
Oh, he was a hero of mine. I was devastated when he died.
Mm. He's one of the ones I thought, I'll meet you. This will happen. Mm. We'll sort this. Then fate had other plans.
Well, I talked about this in another podcast, but my favourite film of all time is Superman the Movie.
Mm.
It wouldn't be my favourite film of all time without Tom Mankiewicz. So.
No. And his finger is actually on a lot more Bond films than he gets credit for. He had a little sweep through on the later 70s ones. And then,
Spy You Love Me.
Yeah, and then also Gremlins, Batman. He there's lots of films that he had his... fingerprints on. I know one of his nephews, I think, just by a social media, he's a sort of anchor man in America.
Yes.
Josh Mankiewicz.
It is Josh Mankiewicz.
And he just privately told me some lovely stories, you know, the right things you want to hear about Tom just being a cool cat and the one the younger Mankiewiczes used to look up to.
Yes, I wrote an obituary of Mankiewicz with a website I used to work with, used to write for, and Josh retweeted it.
Mm. He's a good guy.
He loved him. Yeah, as we all did.
Yeah, and he, there's such a story there. I've got his book as well. You probably have it as well, but I'd urge people to read it because it's very insightful about Hollywood and just structuring a story in a contemporary way. Yeah, anyone can know how to write and structure a script, but to give it a contemporary resonance, you know, and that's what he did with Diamonds Are Forever and Superman.
Well, if you ever want a joy for two and a bit hours, I strongly recommend you listen to the Superman the Movie commentary with him and Richard Donner.
Mm. Mm.
It's just two old Hollywood friends just chatting.
Yeah.
And also coming to the table with the same opinion of this is not going to be as we're not pissing about. We're going to make it set almost Nolan-esque, as Nolan-esque as you could get in those days.
Mm. Mm.
Of saying, we're setting this in the real world. We're not having Telly Savalas cameoing or, you know.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Anyway, we've crossed.
Dr. No.
Yes, Dr. No. Back to the beginning.
So Bond arrives in Jamaica. He gets picked up by a driver, but he doesn't trust him at all. And he's quite smug when he says to him, where are you from? And he says, Government House. So he says, I'm just going to use the phone. And he nips out and rings Government House. And they're like, no, we haven't sent a driver.
Mm.
And I enjoy that because he's very smug.
Mm. That's a good beat of Bond being ahead of the audience. And it's one of those little rewards. Oh, I like him. And pulling him into the character. And it also has the broccoli chauffeur thing, which I am biased. I'll always notice this. But almost every Bond film has a chauffeur in it.
That's true.
In fact, in Skyfall,
he
plays the chauffeur. He's at the airport trailing Berenice Marlowe.
So he gets in the car and he's being tailed. The driver starts driving really fast and he says, we're being tailed. So Bond gets him to pull off. Not like that. And so they stop. And then he just says to him, I know you're not from Government House. Where are you from? And then they have that little fight where the guy runs at him and Bond just does that sort of judo flip.
Yeah, he does that weird, it's almost like Bambi and Thumper rehearsal. It's like they're blocking the Bambi and Thumper scene 9 years later.
Mm. But it turns out the guy won't tell him and then just takes the suicide pill. In much the same way I'd do if James Corden ever spoke to me.
Yeah, but I'd never pick James Corden up from a Jamaican airport.
No, it's true.
Because he'd never be cast in a James Bond film, so.
Oh, don't say that. He's going to be now, isn't he?
Oh, no. I watched Cats. I watched Cats the other day. He was actually the only decent thing in it because he turns to the camera and almost does a, yeah, it's this bad.
Yes. So Bond drives to the Government House and speaks to them and then says, basically, I want to see everybody Strangways was playing with that night. And then he says, I want to see them in their natural environment.
Yes.
And then like they're pandas.
Yes. And I love how Jamaica's quite dangerous. I mean, it is when it's come up again, and who knows what. I mean, it keeps coming back to No Time to Die, doesn't it? But I love, again, the Bond films always get accused of being these sort of glamour locale Miami hotspots, and they are, obviously, but often they're not. So at the beginning of Dr. No, where we see the three blind men, so they're trailing along some dirt track curb, although I don't understand how they can walk so near the curb if they're blind. And it's the back end of Jamaica, and I like when Bond does that. I want more back ends of places, as it were, in the Bond.
It's like the Man with the Golden Gun. There's no part of the Man with the Golden Gun, but it looks like, oh, I'd love to go there.
Yes,
apart from the island at the end, but everything else looks like a shit.
It's sort of like the night, the street scenes. It's sort of like Woking. It's sort of
horrible.
Yeah.
So he goes to meet everybody at the club, and then sort of says to everybody, you know, does Strangways have any enemies or anything he did that was a bit weird? And everybody's just like, oh, I don't know, I can't think of anything. And then Dent's like, he probably eloped with his secretary. She was rather nice.
Mm.
Which instantly makes him a suspect.
Yes, in that sort of Profumo era world.
Oh, yeah. And then Playdell Smith, who's one of the people who was playing with Strangway tonight, says his latest big obsession was fishing. And his friend Potter mentions that a chap called Quarrel was the most expensive to charter of all the fishermen, which I'm assuming means he also offered sort of hand relief.
Possibly, yes, possibly. Mm-hmm. And photo ops, so that photos can be left on sort of narrative shelves at the right moment.
Yes, they certainly can.
What is it about fishing photos in films always give away things? It's not just Bond. There's always, look who he went fishing with in this picture, yes.
Also, the fishing people he goes away with always get killed.
That's true, yeah. He's not perhaps the best.
Or maybe Quarrel Jr.'s all right. I can't remember. I think he's all right.
Yeah, Bond's...
But certainly Sharky.
Bond's TripAdvisor reverse review's probably not great, actually.
No. Don't ever go fishing with this man.
Yeah, I'm thinking of... what's her name? Actress in Thunderball. Met her recently and she hasn't aged, which is...
I know
Martine,
the one you mean.
Martine Bezzett, yeah. Martine Bezzett. She's also doing a bit of fishing and comes a cropper as well. And Valerie Leon in... Never Say Never Again. Yeah, there's a do not go fishing with Bond.
Yeah. I read that on the net.
Oh, the interwebs.
Yeah. Bond goes to see Quarrel and says, he says to a woman, can you tell me where I can find Quarrel? And she should say, outside Wetherspoons at 11.
But no,
she wouldn't know because Wetherspoons didn't exist then.
So, yeah, he goes and finds the local cleaning his boat and all of that.
Yeah. And then basically, and then the guy says, oh, just follow me. And he takes him into the back room of a bar and attacks him. But he hasn't countered with the fact that it's James Bond who knows how to judo flip.
Into empty boxes of Red Stripe.
Loads of them.
Yeah. Which I'm sure was probably an early product placement. Again, the Bond films. Oh, it's ridiculous that Bond's drinking Heineken and there's beer and booze adverts everywhere. Well, again, it was there in the beginning. It's there in the novels.
Yep. I love all the product placement Bond films. I mean, some of the later ones have been a bit in your face, but sometimes they were just quite fun. Like the, you know, you think of the tank going through the Perrier in GoldenEye.
Mm, and the BA billboards in Rio, the British yes. Airways ones, and the Cinzano. Well, I love Moonraker because it's like 7-Up, Cinzano, Concorde. Yep. It's that.
There's also a bit in The Living Daylights when he's driving through Gibraltar in the, you know, when he's in the Jeep.
Mm.
They go through loads of umbrellas, which are somehow, I can't remember which alcohol it is now.
It's all those ones your parents used to have in the cupboards.
Yeah,
and you wouldn't, exactly. When they went away when you were like 15 or 16. In fact, first time I got really drunk or drunk ever was on Cinzano because I thought it must be posh because it's always in Bond films on like sort of umbrellas that get knocked sideways. I'm not joking there either.
It's like Canada Dry as well, stuff like that.
Yeah. So, yeah, first time I was age 15, got really drunk. Went to see Rocky Five with a mate and then we got bladdered on Cinzano. Yeah.
So Bond thinks he's got the best of these two people and he's backing out of the room and he gets a gun in the back and it's the man that's been telling him, who we don't know who it is yet, but it turns out it's Felix Leiter of the CIA, and Quarrel and the other chap are working with him, so they're all on the same team.
Yeah, it's that and they still do it where, oh, who's this mm-hmm. new, that's why they keep changing the actor. It's to yeah. reignite that little trope and trick of I suppose it still works. It's still cool when we realise it's Jeffrey Wright, but I'd love it if they cast a Felix who we didn't know was in the film. So suddenly, you know, it's...
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
My favourite one, he's not Felix. He's smartly connected to Felix, but it's in Live and Let Die where Rog knocks out the two guys who are about to kill him. And as he goes to pick up the gun, you hear, drop it!
Mm. Yeah.
And it turns out it's the guy working for Felix.
Yes. Yeah.
Who says, good disguise, Bond, a white man in Harlem.
Yes, exactly. That great scene with Felix... He's holding up the ties and Bond goes, that's a little frenetic, that'll do, and get rid of that. It's sort of just like, done.
A genuine Felix Leiter.
Mm.
So Felix, they're all on the same team, and they go for a bar at night, and they meet this girl who's been photographing James since he arrived at the airport. And this bit's just weird.
Mm. Mm.
Where she's basically saying that she's been paid to take pictures of him.
Mm.
When they try and hold her against the wheel, she smashes one of the bulbs from her camera and slices Coral in the face with it. Mm. And he laughs.
Yeah. It's a grim beat, but I think it's grim already when she's licking the bulb at the airport. I mean,
yeah.
Maybe that's like a early photography trick, but it's really kinky and it always underlines the little slight vice and kink of Bond's world. Then when she crunches it and that, you know, that's broken glass is vicious however you use it, and it's still vicious, that little beat. But yeah, he's sort of, and then he's left with that Technicolor red blood that they all have in the movies of that time that doesn't sort of, I don't know what color that red is, but it doesn't actually exist.
I think it's letterbox red.
Yeah it's sort of Golden Gate Bridge red. Yeah
it's so you can see them bleeding at night.
Yes, yeah, and there's loads of that in Doctor No. There's loads of that color.
There is, but they hear that this is where he first starts hearing about how Crab Keys, there's something going on there. So he goes back to see Professor Dent, who was clearly the dodgiest one out of the three, and says, you know, what was your dealing with Strangways? And Dent says that he's a geologist and that Strangways was after some information about some rocks to see if any of them were valuable, but none of them were, and he threw them all away.
Mm.
But he says in such a dodgy way that Bond's like, I don't believe a word you're saying.
Yes, and it's quite brave to sort of make geology. I mean, the next time it does, it's Future Kill. And apart from me, no one like that. But the sort of role of geologist, stones and bricks or rocks are really not great entertainment. But
isn't there a bit of Quantum of Solace with a geologist as well?
Oh, yes, Slate, who sounds like a rock. Yes. Yeah.
Yes, he does. There you go. But then he's a bit spooked by Bond's visit, so he goes to visit. He goes all the way to Crab Key to visit Dr. No. And he's shown into what looks like the interior of a bath. So you've got this kind of big white room, and then you've got this cross in the ceiling that comes down. It looks like he's a plug hole.
Mm.
And he's basically said, you have to kill this man. He's a nuisance. And so he gives him a giant spider.
It's a beautiful moment there, and I think it was probably like like most, a bit like Morris Binder suddenly panicking and finding some white dots 10 minutes before his title sequence pitch. But I'm sure there's some improvisation last minute thing where Ken Adam did, well, it's probably lack of budget. You know, what can you do when you haven't got a budget? Well, I'll just, you know, I'll create one wall or the impression of a wall, and I'll use a shadow to create the rest. And it's beautiful, and it's it's all, again, it's all over, you know, the new villain in the next James Bond film. There's an element of that sort of beautiful Ken Adam sense of Cold War modernism.
And that's end of part one of this episode of Smirchpod. We'll be back later in the week with part two, so please stick around. But in the meantime, why not like, subscribe, review, enjoy, share, tell everybody you like. And, you know, why not even buy Thunderbook? Hey, why not? See you next time.
All the people down Kingston Town, you know, all the people go jump up. Waving arms about, weaving in and out, it's so easy to jump up. Take a pretty girl, make a whirl, and then both begin again, jump up. Hold her very tight, then for all the night, you'll be doing the jump up. Together now, jump up, Jamaica, bump up, bump up. Jamaica, jump up, music, to make you never want to stop. Jump up, Jamaica, bump up, bump up. Jamaica, jump up, music, to make you never want to stop. Jump up. Listen to the band take her hand and say, here we go again, jump up. Like a ball of fire, you will never tire when you're doing the jump up. All the people down Kingston Town, you know, all the people go jump up. You'll be lost a week once you're fried up and never give up the jump up. Jump up, jump up, Jamaica, bump up, bump up. Jamaica, jump up, music.
If you're a fan of all things geeky, you're going to love Con Sessions, a brand new podcast by comedian Matt Hunton and myself, Beck Hill, where we interview your favourite cult heroes at Comic-Cons all across the world. We've got stars from Star Wars, Harry Potter, The Walking Dead, and more. Make sure you tune in soon to Con Sessions.
GreatBigOwl.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.